This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Welcome to the Wheeler Centre. I'm Hilary Harper, who I present the 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria breakfast program on a Saturday morning. I'd like to acknowledge that we're meeting today on the traditional lands of the Kulin Nation, and I pay my respects to their elders past and present and to the elders of all other communities. Now, Hannah Kent is a bit terrifyingly talented, but you'll be heartened to know that at one point in her childhood she was sent to school dressed as Jane Fonda because she had to become an athlete, so she's human like the rest of us. Burial Rights, her first book, was an international bestseller, 28 languages, nominated for a swag of awards. It won the ABIA Literary Fiction Book of the Year, the Indie Awards Debut Fiction Book of the Year, and the Victorian Premier's People's Choice Award. Now we have The Good People, which is about more dark deeds in cold places, as I think one of your friends put it. Please welcome her to the Wheeler Centre tonight. I was a bit surprised to see that your Twitter picture has you smiling broadly, though you are surrounded by snow, so in character so far.
That's true, yeah. I think people expect me to be a lot more sort of morose and grim and just always, well, I am dressed in black, so I'm fulfilling that part of it. But yeah, no, quite a cheerful person in real life, surprisingly.
Well, then, your friend was saying, you know, dark deeds in cold places, yeah. And one of the Goodreads reviewers I read said, yep, it's another kind of set of eerie and dreary landscapes, but not facts. You know, the book that was compelling to all the reviewers I read. To what extent do you think are those dark deeds generated by the cold places? What role does the landscape play?
I think for me, I really enjoy these kinds of landscapes. I mean, the dark deeds, finding these stories, I mean, both books have been based on true events, and finding those stories which inspired the novel, that's been more sort of coincidence than design. But there is something about, I think, especially small communities in isolated places. You can get almost this intensity of feeling and situations which escalate really quickly. And I think that's what interests me. But also in a historical setting, I think landscape is pretty crucial. I remember once interviewing the US writer Ron Rash, the author of Serena, amongst other works, and he said during the interview, landscape is destiny. And I think that's really stayed with me. So, yeah, landscape and particularly gloomy landscapes, I can't really go past when it comes to characterisation.
There's a lot of rain in The Good People.
Yeah, it is Ireland. So,
well, how different are Ireland and Iceland in that? It's a very similar time period. It's the 1820s, 1830s. How similar were they in the rural parts of the lands at that point?
They were actually pretty different. Iceland was, I mean, Ireland at that time, there was a lot going on. It was fairly, you know, well populated, as sort of evidenced later by the trauma that the famine basically unfurled upon the countryside. There were so many deaths because the population was so high. In Iceland, you still had, it was a different kind of level. In Iceland at the time, people were literate but incredibly poor. The communities were very small. You wouldn't have a national sort of railway network. You didn't have schools. You didn't have jails. Yet in Ireland at that time, I guess you had more industry. You had workhouses. Shortly afterwards, they'd started doing the ordnance surveys, that sort of thing. So in some ways, it was more of a bustling metropolis, I guess, certainly in the more urban areas than Iceland, but in other ways you had a lot more illiteracy, again, very extreme poverty, and that, of course, shaped the ways that certain classes, I guess, lived.
Well, and you've said that partly this story came out about because you got tired of translating endless Icelandic sources, as you do, sitting at home writing. How did that boredom lead to this story?
Yeah, it's funny. I guess this comes down to, again, a few people have already asked me, you know, do you have a thing for, you know, like, again, miserable people in cold places and crime and, you know, murderous women and all these sorts of things? And again, it was mere coincidence. About 98% of the sources that I had to translate, even just to find out if they were useful for my research, were in Icelandic. And I speak the language, but it's one thing to be able to go into a cafe and order a coffee and a bun and also, you know, sit and translate execution documents. So it was really, really tedious for me. And I remember one afternoon I just had enough. So I thought, oh, it's a bit of a cop-out, but I'll go read some old British newspapers to see if they mentioned the execution or the crime in them, as they sometimes did with foreign events. And, of course, they didn't have anything in them. But as I was browsing through these newspapers, I came across this very brief but rather extraordinary newspaper article which talked about an old woman of advanced age, they called her. She could have been 40 probably back then. called Nance Roach, who had been accused of quite a serious crime, but her defence was so extraordinary that I immediately wrote it out in my notebook, and I thought, I'll have to come back to that one. She had basically been accused of a violent crime, and she had said that she wasn't guilty, and the reason being that the person, her victim, wasn't a person at all. It was a fairy changeling, and that she had been trying to cure this changeling, trying to restore the human in it. I mean, what heady stuff. So I couldn't forget it. Oh, and years later, once I'd finished Burial Rites and I was asked about a second novel, I immediately thought, old Nance Roach, I'll come back to her.
Well, how deep was that overlay of folk belief over Catholicism, or you know, what was that layering at that time? Because a lot of the characters in your book have a deep commitment to at least appearing to be Christian.
I think this is what's so interesting about this particular time period, particularly in Ireland. For many, many years, as sort of the church rose to power in Ireland and Catholicism took hold, it sort of amalgamated with these older ancient pagan beliefs, of which, you know, some of which regarded the fairies and were all about fairy lore. And so you have a lot of Irish fairy stories which talk about the fairy plaguing a poor farmer because he built their house on one of their fairy paths. So the priest is summoned and the priest discusses it with the fairies. You know, it was sort of one and the same. Fairies were just part of the fabric of everyday life, part of the everyday Catholic life. But then at around this time, I think particularly in the push for Catholic emancipation, you see a separation between the clergy and official sort of Catholic doctrine and these older ways. And you see a slow disintegration of those older ways in the face of a renewed sort of church authority in these communities. And that was really interesting as well, looking at the slow sort of separation of the two.
But obviously very slow, and it's at one point where the priest is called to deal with a curse that's been found that is a part of the older folkloric belief. And the villagers are basically instructing him how much holy water to use and what to do. It's like, we know what needs to be done, what power needs to be exerted here.
Yeah.
We don't really care where it comes from. It's kind of the same for them, but the priest is frustrated and confused because for him they're quite separate.
Exactly. And you know what? I think in certain parts of Ireland you still see that. I remember, this is me going on a tangent, but it's a good story, I promise. I remember when I was researching in Ireland and I met a man who told me about a friend of his who is a priest. And the priest had been recently summoned to a farm where a farmer's cow had been sort of struck down, wasn't doing too well. The priest, when he got there, the farmer had also called a vet, standard, and also a fairy doctor, someone who could speak with the fairies. And the priest was like, okay, well, nice to know you've got a lot of faith in the church, but sure, I'll pray over your cow. And he did. And then the vet was already sort of like, look, I've taken a look at her. She's not looking good. I'm afraid there's nothing we can really do. We should put her down. And then comes the fairy doctor, and he comes down and he whispers in her ear. And the priest saw the ice on the lintel of the barn begin to melt. And at the time that I was told this story, the priest was tearing his hair out because he had to fill in all the paperwork for witnessing a miracle. So it still happens. People still hedge their bets and sort of summon the doctor, the priest, and the fairy doctor.
That's another novel, the that paperwork involved novel. In a belief system. Is it a belief system? It involved paper. Anyway. I wonder how we got from, the kind of idea of fairies that sees them as basically Puck to Tinkerbell, because the fairies in this, or the idea of fairies, is terrifying and dark, and they kind of need to be, don't they, to perform the function that the villagers require them to function.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we do have this really sort of watered-down, Disney-fied idea of fairies, but you go back, just like you do with really most fairy tales that have been passed down, like Cinderella. To watch a Disney Cinderella, it's all rather sweet and saccharine. You know, you don't have the original story where the stepsisters are carving off their heels to squish their bloodied feet into the glass shoe, but I think if you dig back far enough, all of these things are very dark indeed.
Well, and I read recently that the glass is actually a mistranslation of fur.
Oh.
And so it had quite a different tone to it in the original, because it was about the girl reaching puberty, and, you know, the foot inserted into this slipper had a whole wealth of meaning. So, yeah, that doesn't really make it into Disney these days.
No. Well, I wonder what would happen if they brought that back. There'd be an outcry.
Yeah.
But no, you're exactly right. And I mean, fairy lore often stood in as almost a vernacular with which you could talk about things that were taboo, or you almost needed to borrow a kind of dialogue to talk about things like the inexplicable in many ways. And that's what the fairy stood in for, both inexplicably tragic events, but also inexplicably good. You know, if someone suddenly had or just seemed to have incredible musical talent, you'd say they had fairy skill with the pipe or a fairy voice or something like that. And similarly, if someone was struck down or there was a whole run of deaths in the family, people couldn't work it out. Fairies stood in as a kind of rationality. They were their own logic, and they enabled people, I think, to discuss things that, like we have in fairy tales, were perhaps a little bit taboo, a little bit unsavoury.
And interestingly, the twin belief systems of Christianity or Catholicism and the folkloric belief strike me a little bit about similar to the way that some people try to combine, say, religion and science. And in a way, there's something of that going on here in the way people try to use a form of deduction to work out what is happening. It's like they're saying, look, this superstition is a thing and it has a system. I just need to work out what's happening rather than whether I believe in it or not.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of these things as well, I did a lot of research of herbal remedies as well. And within all of that, you have sometimes real scientific uses of plants that we continue to use today, St. John's wort for depression and so forth, vervain for sleeping or sleeplessness. But then amongst these, you also have the idea of sympathetic magic, which basically comes down to the world is in secret sympathy with itself. If your child has jaundice, is looking pretty yellow, then let's go find some yellow plants to make a tea for your yellow child, because yellow will act on yellow. So, and I found that fascinating, actually. By the end of most of my research, I felt I'd almost nailed. I could almost find that particular logic in all of these old rituals and superstitions. It's there. It's just completely alien to our modern ways of thinking.
And how much of it turned out to be accurate in modern scientific terms?
Well, this is what I find endlessly fascinating. So I often use the example of foxglove, which was known as the fairy's plant because it could be poisonous. It could be fatal. People died after taking foxglove. But also sometimes it could miraculously heal people. And foxglove, as some of you might know, contains digitalis, which is now used for medicine for arrhythmia and heart trouble and things like that. And it does have a very powerful effect on the body. But people who were using it didn't know in what quantities. They didn't know what specific illnesses it needed to be treated with. And so because it was so unpredictable, that's how it started to acquire this kind of supernatural agency. It was one of the fairies plant, and it was another way, I suppose, of telling the community you should only let, you know, the professionals, the fairy doctors, the people who already know how the fairies work, use that plant and will stay away from it. So it is there. And I mean, if you look at foxglove, it looks completely weird and supernatural anyway. It's a very odd plant.
Well, and there was this wonderful kind of massive distrust and massive lure of the handy woman and the people who knew about the fairy lore. They were feared and revered at the same time. How much of that is still around? I mean, you took a trip to Ireland to kind of cement your research. What did you find?
I think in some ways it's quite sad. I think a lot of the stories of the wise woman, or the hag, or the crone as she's known, never really the witch in Ireland. They didn't really have witchcraft per se. It was always this wise woman. A lot of it has really died away. There is one very famous wise woman, which I think she's got a bunch of pubs and probably beer and whiskey named after her, called Biddy Early. And Biddy Early did exist. She lived in the 19th century, and she was known to be someone who was in with them, in with the fairies. People spoke about growing up with her, and she'd disappear off under a white thorn and speak to the fairies, and that's how she got her knowledge. They gave her a bottle, and if you came to her with an illness, she'd already know what was wrong with you, but she'd look into a bottle and she'd give you the cure. And I think with the famine, a lot of these women who occupied a role of such as Biddy Early, a lot of their knowledge was lost. It existed in an oral culture. And with the famine came mass immigration, mass death, a lot of people, you know, basically relegated to workhouses. And so a lot of these stories were completely forgotten. And I think Biddy Early is a great example because she's now become a legend. And I think her character as we know her today is really a bunch of different women's stories all piled into the one until you have this mythical figure. I tried to learn as much as possible about these particular women and their role in communities, and I found that, as often is the case with women's stories, my best source was in accidental anecdote through speaking with Irish people and listening to the stories their grandmothers told them. But it was quite difficult.
Well, how did you get yourself into this early modern world? I mean, did you just do a lot of camping and wear homespun? Because the detail is incredible of people's houses and the tools and the very few daily objects that they use to live.
Ireland actually does have fantastic resources for the past. I was doing research, I guess, in a couple of different directions. One was in all those old folk remedies and rituals and the superstitions, and the other was just really ordinary things. You know, what do people eat? What did they wear? How often did they bathe? And another funny story, if you'll indulge me, Hilary. I remember once I went to a lot of outdoor museums, you know, where people sort of do recreations and things. And often the houses and homes they've recreated are not exactly what I'm looking for. My characters are much more sort of lower down on the social scale than the farms that they generally recreate in these museums. But still, you can go in and you can smell the turf smoke and you can knock on the walls and you can see the lime wash and all these sorts of beautiful details. But I remember I went to one such museum. And I went to go speak to the foyer and said, look, do you have anything from sort of pre-famine era that I can go have a look at? And they said, look, no, we don't really. But look, I'll call down one of the curators to come and talk with you and she might be able to help you out. And until this time in my research trip, I'd been dealing solely with sort of very mature academics. And down skips this 26-year-old. And I thought, oh, this is interesting. What an interesting person. And I invited her out for coffee. And she said, look, there's nothing I can help you with. We don't have anything like that, unfortunately. But we did go out and we started chatting. And she told me about her boss and said, look, I've just texted my boss about you. She says that she knows your first book. Would you like to go out to dinner? So that night we all went out to dinner together. And I met her boss, who was this beautiful woman. And she was saying, look, I've got something I think might help you, and I'm only going to give it to you. I'm going to lend it to you. We're going to go back to the museum, and I'm going to get it, and then you can give it back to me tomorrow. And the only reason I'm doing this is because I liked your first book, and you better make a good second one. So I was like, okay, let's do that then. So we went back to the museum, and she handed me the most extraordinary resource. It was a tiny little box, and in it was about 100 or so index cards, upon which she had very carefully, many years ago when she was doing her PhD thesis, typed out particular information from the Poor Inquiry. So the Poor Inquiry was when men were sent out to sort of assess the lives and the misery, really, of the peasantry in their areas, and then they reported back. And she had gone through and picked out all the little details of dress, of what people ate, of how wide their houses were, and meticulously stuck it on index cards and then filed them according to subject. And she handed me this and said, this is my treasure box. Bring it back to me by 10 a.m. So I scurried back home and just photocopied and wrote down as many notes as possible. And that was remarkable. That would have taken me years to try and find that information. So it's amazing what you can find.
Yes, well, and I was wondering how much attention the case got at the time. Were there court transcripts or newspaper cuttings, or was it just kind of, oh, I'm going to make it up a bit?
I searched for them. When I decided to base a book on this particular story, I thought I might go about it in a similar way to burial rites, where I did end up finding a whole bunch of information. But after several weeks searching in Dublin, the only thing I had, and I found it by pure coincidence, was one other newspaper article. I'd been in the Dublin Library and I'd managed to find about three local newspapers in the area where I knew this crime had occurred. And one of them had records from that particular year. And I thought, oh, how fantastic. But I don't know how many of you have done... I'm getting all, like, excited about my nerdy research. I don't know how many of you have had to go through things on microfilm, but it can take a massive amount of time because you're scrolling through this fine print, and I didn't know when the actual crime had occurred. I knew the trial date, so I was looking through it. It was taking me days and days and days, and I was getting closer and closer to the trial date, and I thought, it'll be mentioned any time now. It's going to pop up. And then I met with a six-month break, just gone. And I went to the bathroom and cried. And then I came back and I thought, well, there's nothing for it. I'm just not going to ever find anything. So I picked up a Cork paper, a neighbouring county paper, and I just thought, well, I'll have a flip through and try to get a sense of people's lives and what was going on in the countryside. And as I was skipping through it, I recognised the name Nance Roach, and that article had been syndicated. And I found that one other article, and that's how I found out about the other two women who would become the other two major characters in the novel. But that's all I had. I could find nothing else about this case.
Because it's the relationships between those women and the contrast between them that are key. I think that there's that central tragedy of the boy that Nora is looking after, her grandson, who was healthy when he was two, a perfect child, and when he came to her after his mother died, her only daughter, he was ailing. Mm. And then there's Nance, the handy woman, and then there's Mary. Tell us why you decided to put Mary in as someone who came to help Nora.
Well, Mary was mentioned as a witness in the article, and I didn't really make much of her. I thought she might be a neighbour or just a local woman in the community. And then again, through happenstance, I happened to meet two academics and researchers who specialised in hiring fairs in Ireland. And I was telling them about my research, and I mentioned Mary Clifford, who was described as being a servant to Nora. And they said, oh, you know that she would have been very young, because servants were generally anywhere from, people were hired out from the age of 7 basically through to 14 or 15. And then suddenly that changed it for me. I thought, how extraordinary to have someone who is much younger and therefore much less, really disempowered in that kind of situation. How would that play out with this particular situation? So I never really found anything about the true character, but it was very much based on the lives of these hired children, really, back then. Very poor children who were sent out to make money for their families.
Well, there's a wonderful line where Nora reflects on how easy it is to be good. I mean, she's grieving. Her husband has died. Her daughter has died. She's looking after her grandson, Michael, who is very difficult to deal with. And Mary comes to live with her, and she's, she's saying perhaps we're only good when life makes it easy for us to be so. Mm. But Mary provides quite a contrast, doesn't she? She thinks differently from Nora a lot of the time.
She does. I'm very fond of Mary as a character. I remember being 14. I had a very sort of, in some ways, quite black and white world view, in the sense that I felt I had a very good sense of what was right and what was wrong. And I wanted to bring that to the character of Mary, because I think as an adult, particularly a character like Nora, who is experiencing this overwhelming grief, who almost can't trust the person that she was or her life back then. She feels utterly changed by it and utterly disorientated by the events around her. I wanted to have someone for whom life and decisions and behaviour was much more simple, and sort of have them in contrast.
But it's not that life is simple for her, is it? Because she's terrified of what might be going on. She's worried about the grief eating away at the timber of Nora, as you say in the book. And she's wondering whether to follow the advice of Nance, who they ask to kind of help them in this this decision that they have to make. And I'm wondering, how much power did women have? Because the book seems to me to be this fantastic balance between the showing the constraints of that life, but also the wiggle room that people found to change the narrative being built up around them by rumour or gossip or the community, and the narrative that they wrote themselves for their life. But the constraints were huge, weren't they?
They were, and I think it's worth saying that they were particularly, women's lives were limited when they were poor. I think that this is something that, this often comes up, I suppose, particularly with burial rites, but I think women often historically have had less power, less authority, less influence in sort of public institutions particularly than men. However, when you throw class into the mix, that's when you really see people's lives constrained simply by fewer opportunities, fewer choices, fewer resources. And if you also have people who don't have family and don't have any money and are women, that's really when you see them hugely constrained by their circumstances. And I think that's often where you have people make decisions that they really feel they have no choice but to make.
Yeah, it's interesting because Nance is powerless in a way because of her solitude and her spinsterhood, and therefore her difference. You know, she's not linked to man or hearth, you know, no kids, no home as such. And Michael is powerless because he's crippled and, you know, has no speech and is entirely dependent on others. But it's really interesting, the dynamic between them and the choices that Nance makes. And I found that fascinating, that you chose to have people make different choices even though they are constrained by much of the same stuff. What were you trying to tell us when we look at Nance's life? What lessons are we learning about how she lives?
Oh, I don't know if there's a lesson. With Nance, I was really fascinated at basically by how someone might come to occupy this kind of role in a community where their difference is crucial to their independence and to their survival in that community. And I think for someone like Nance, she almost needs to sort of emphasise her own eccentricity so that people will believe that she is someone who goes with the fairies, so that they believe in her skill and see in her strangeness and in their own fear of her a kind of, you know, that's really the source of their respect for her as well. She can't appear vulnerable either, so she needs to sort of show that she's independent and capable of looking after herself, because otherwise people will start to also doubt her ability. And that's really, I think, what is at stake for Nance throughout the novel, how she relies on fairy lore as a means for empowerment, because she's an incredibly vulnerable person otherwise. And I think you see the sort of slow emergence of that vulnerability and her fear of being seen in that way is very much sort of an underlying sort of current in terms of her character motivation.
And it's really interesting too how a lot of the authority figures are men. The priest comes in from outside and pronounces and then goes away, and the law comes in from outside and deals with things. But the women of the village generate so much of the tension and fear, and there's this noose of rumour that tightens around people. So that's a really interesting dynamic. Was that deliberate?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really interested in pack mentality. And I think we see this still. It's very much a contemporary concern. It never goes away. It's universal. But I'm really interested in the way in which people kind of, if they feel part of a crowd or if they feel part of a community even, it's much easier for them to stop regarding others as individuals. They feel absolved of any responsibility they might feel towards an individual. And I think gossip is one of those things that enables people to feel part of that pack and to other others. That's really badly put, but I'm sure you know what I mean. And so that was certainly something I wanted to explore. And having lived in a lot of small communities, there's a lot which is wonderful about it. But when things go bad, sometimes there's really curious tensions, which I like to explore.
There's a wonderful story where Mary says, "My brother told me that eels can put their tails in their mouth and roll like a hoop across the land, and I don't trust an animal that can do that." Yeah. It's like there's so much reliance on the word of other uneducated, ignorant people. And that's terrifying. I just love that there's this. I mean, I wonder how much better things are these days, where we feel like we're much more rational and there's much more room for rationality. But on the other hand, we have this tool that's an incredible disseminating force for really bad ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I never really think that the past was, obviously, you know, it's nice to be able to wear shoes and have modern medicine. But there's you know, a lot of things, I think, in the book which are just as evident in today's modern society.
I'm also wondering how far we've come in our treatment of people with disabilities, because while there's a lot of blaming other people for their ill fortune in other ways, there's this incredible unwillingness to see someone with a disability as fully human. In the book, at one point you say Mary tended the child like a mourner over a corpse, and there's that sense of a kind of lesser human. And that was really a grueling way to read the book. There's this sense of inevitability throughout the book. I mean, do you feel like things have changed much, or was that a olden times thing? Don't have to worry about that now.
I don't have any personal experience with disability, so I feel that I can't really speak about modern sort of experiences or whether that attitude has changed. I think what I was really fascinated in is looking at disability in the book, in the sort of context of fairy lore, and looking at the way in which people, when confronted with something that they didn't understand and didn't made them feel uneasy, really, because of that difference, that very apparent difference, the way that they felt that they could fall back on, again, this fairy vernacular to say, okay, it's actually out of our control. This is something that I bear no blame for. Because this was also another thing back then. If, say, for instance, that you had a child who had a hare lip, people would think that you didn't take enough precautions as a pregnant woman, that you had met with a hare in the road and you hadn't crossed yourself or you hadn't said a prayer, and that's why your child was born with this hare lip. And there was a lot of other things. If you had a child who was born with something with our modern understanding of science and medicine, was born with a recognisable disability. Back then, people would think, well, what did you do? What didn't you do to protect your child? There were all these things that people would do to take precautions. You know, if your child stumbled, you were supposed to spill milk. You were supposed to do certain things with the teeth and with the hair. You were supposed to bar their cradle with iron because fairies don't like iron and wouldn't be able to steal your child. Maybe if you hadn't done that, people would look at your child and think, well, you're a careless woman, you know, you didn't do enough. It's a sort of mother guilt, which is still evident and still present in it, very much in our society. So I was interested, I suppose, in looking at the ways in which you could carry on that line of thinking to a certain degree, and then you come a point when you think, no, I did everything I could. This is beyond that. The fairies have simply taken this child. This is not even a human anymore. And what does that do to the individual? Do you feel relieved? Does that allow you to give in to emotions that otherwise were completely unsavory and kind of contradictory to your self-identity and your perception of your own goodness? So I think these were the things that I was really trying to get at. But I really don't feel I have enough experience or sort of any authority to comment on modern attitudes towards disability, because I know they're huge and varied as well.
Well, and I think I projected a lot onto this book because I have a child with Down syndrome and I'm kind of hyper aware of attitudes to disability, but it worked on so many levels. You know, that was an element that I brought to it, but it was a fascinating look at the way people go, that is frightening and I don't want it to continue. I want the perfect being back. Mm. And it's Nora's belief is really interesting because I guess, should we look at these women, at Nora and Nance, as evil or stupid or ignorant? Because those are things that we often want to project onto people who are accused of crimes these days. Or is there some other way to view them?
It's interesting. This is why I try to avoid the words even superstition in talking about this book, because we have a lot of we associate superstition with ignorance and with stupidity and with sort of blind belief. And I don't really think that these people's fairy belief and fairy lore is as basic as that. Like I said earlier, it does have its own logic. It has its own sort of rationality, and these people could understand that. I think characters like Nance and Nora, they're not evil, just as no one is really evil, but people every day do terrible things. But I think there's a lot of external circumstances that come to influence their behaviour, and the choices that they make are often the only choices they perceive they have, whether or not that's the case. And that kind of blindness to other ways around problems, I think, is also a condition of, you know, heightened emotional circumstances or personal misfortune, or, you know, there's a lot of other instances in the book where bad things happen, but the people have been fasting for 3 days, and, you know, what hunger does to a person, what desperation does to a person. I think desperation can lead to evil behaviour, but I don't think it necessarily reflects on the evil within a person.
Is it hard not to be judgmental of your characters?
I think if I were, I don't think I could write the book, really. For me, fiction very much has to come from a place of empathy, not sympathy. And so, you know, it was tough. It was hard. It was one of the greatest challenges of writing this book, was trying to put myself in these women's sort of shoes and think, okay, how, and adopt their way of thinking. But, yeah, I'm not sure. Maybe it's up for the readers to decide whether or not I've done that successfully. But I certainly don't regard them as ignorant or as... they have their own kind of knowledge. It's just a very foreign type of knowledge and a foreign worldview to our own.
And you've said that you had a lot of pressure on you to write another good book, you know, not just from the curator, after Burial Rites, and that you got around that by just focusing on the sheer love of writing. But obviously there's a sheer love of the really dark side of human nature, and you seem like such a nice woman. What's going on?
Oh, man. Well, it was funny. I think I remember watching an interview with Emily Watson, the actress, many, many years ago. She starred in a bunch of Lars von Trier films, you know, really dark roles. And someone asked her a similar question, you know, how come you always go for this really dark stuff? And she said, well, I had a very lovely, happy, stable childhood, and that's almost like my anchor. It lets me sort of lean over into the really dark places because I know I can bounce back because I have that stability. I wonder whether maybe that's the same case. I have my bad days, Hilary. I've got my grim and gloomy days just like anyone else.
I'm not quite happy to hear that, but it is reassuring. What do you think the other villagers would have thought of what Nance and Nora did? Because the court system made its judgment. Mm. How did that sit with the belief system that was current in the village, do you think?
Well, this is, I guess, speaks to, again, the ambiguity and the, you know, the real deep complexity of fairy belief, because the villagers have this same belief and this same attitude towards fairies. They're engaging in the same rituals. They're pouring Beasting's milk at the foot of white thorns and calling them the good people. They possess the same belief, but I think there does come a point where they feel that things have gone too far. You know, things have disrupted the order and the rules that also exist for men, whether those be sort of legal, you know, legal in the sense of court of law laws, or whether it's more sort of laws of community. You know, what we have things that we need to do to stay together, to survive as a band of people. So, and there is sort of, I guess, by the end, a sense of transgression. But it's that itself is still hard. I think various characters in the community, there's quite a lot of smaller, minor characters, they have various attitudes towards the fairies. Some don't really believe in them, but then also won't say that they don't, just in case. Some, the rituals, it's just a part of their way of life. They've just adopted it, but it doesn't necessarily speak to any deep-seated fear or hope or desperation. I'm not too sure. It's a very famous case in Ireland, which happened in 1895, when a woman called Bridget Cleary was burned to death and tortured by her family and her husband, who believed that she was a fairy. And there's this wonderful book called The Burning of Bridget Cleary, written by an Irish writer and academic called Angela Burke. And this book was wonderful because Angela spends a lot of time not only going over the case, but looking at sort of the ripple effect of this in the wider community, and looking at the way it either disrupted other people's belief in fairy lore, but also how they responded to something which, again, they recognised as a transgression. So I did draw a lot on that, but it was a tough one. I had to go by it, I think, on a case-by-case basis with most of the characters.
Well, and that's one thing that stood out for me is, I hope I'm not sounding too gushy about this book, but I really, really liked it. There were a lot of the characters, you call them minor characters, but they're really complex and fully formed, and they add to that sense that people make choices, even no matter how constrained the choices are. There are choices in what to think and choices in what to say, even about the fairies. I found that fascinating. I wondered whether you read any Seamus Heaney and how important his poetry was. I've been waiting for a chance to put this in. So maybe it has arrived. Was he, you know, what did he think about the ordinary people of Ireland?
I loved Seamus Heaney, and I read a lot of his poetry while I was writing the book. I read a lot of poetry anyway when I'm writing, because I admire the concision and the precision of their words, and that's something I aspire to. But I think he has I lent on his poetry mainly for that beautiful sensory quality that he manages to convey. And because I only managed to have 6 weeks in Ireland, I really lent on that to kind of remind me of my own sensory experiences, you know, the sound of the wind and the feel of a heavy clod of mud on your shoe and the unevenness of tussock ground and mountainside, all of that sort of thing. The ordinary people of Ireland, well, I had so many incredible experiences when I went there myself. I feel very warmly towards them as a people. I was really overwhelmed with their generosity, actually. But, Seamus is great. I must go back and continue to reread his poetry. I've given it a break since finishing the book, but, yeah, I'd love to return to it.
Well, and he really gives a sense of the continuity of life in Ireland, doesn't he? That the pre-modern rural life is completely still alive now, and all those wonderful kind of sounds of spade into turf,
exactly.
And wet bog mud are completely relevant now.
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't manage to get out and spend too much time in sort of rural, regional Ireland because I was sort of going to so many museums, but I did have a great experience of when I got down to the area where the crime occurred. There's this beautiful river called the Flesk River outside of Killarney, and it's mainly all in private ground. And so I decided to stay at a B&B, which was a farm on the river, and it was there that I managed to sort of spend a lot of time squelching around in the rain-sodden paddocks and speaking with the farmer, this wonderful man called Sean O'Donoghue, and he lived there with his mother. And that was fantastic, actually. He ended up taking me. I told him what I was doing. You know, a woman travelling alone, it's good people. It invites a lot of questions. And he said, I told him about the book and the case that I was researching. And he said, we've got a place of historical significance on the farm. And he ended up taking me to a killeen, which is a site of burial for unbaptized children or for stillborn children, children who had not been christened and therefore could not enter heaven. And it was incredible. That was probably the best experience I had in terms of meeting with the locals and learning from I guess, their stories and hearing their anecdotes. But I wish I had more. I wish I had a greater chance to sort of go and really live there and soak it all up. But timing, alas.
Does that still happen?
Do the glean?
Unbaptized babies still segregated after death?
I can't answer that question. I doubt it. I think this particular Killeen was very old. There was an old standing stone. You could see that it was, even though it was unconsecrated ground, it was still a place of power. There was something of the sacred about this particular spot. And Sean O'Donoghue actually felt so badly towards these poor buried babies there in the middle of his cow paddocks that he invited the local priest and parishioners to come, and they consecrated the ground. So the ground is now consecrated, and I feel like they perhaps wouldn't have done that had that still been the way of things.
When you were writing Agnes Magnusdottir's life for her burial rites, when there wasn't much concrete information, you had to kind of join the dots. You've said that some things happened that defied logic and that didn't really want to go into them any further. But is what happened then partly why you wanted to look at this intersection between, you know, what we don't know and what we have to decide on?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that influenced my interest. I think most people have an interest in things like synchronicity and coincidence and strange things that happen in our lives. You know, for every person who says they don't believe in ghosts, they'll be like, oh, I don't believe in ghosts, or, you know, I don't believe in any of that. Oh, but this one thing did happen to me one time, you know, and I'm interested in that one time. Those are the stories that compel me. I think if you dig enough into them, you find something intrinsically human and beautiful in that.
When you've said that when you finished that one, you felt this kind of grief because it was a story that had haunted you. Yeah. How did you feel this time when you pressed, you know, save and send?
Tired. No, I felt the whole process of writing this book had its own challenges. I think I thought, having written one book, I'll know what to do for the second. I've got it all mapped out. I've done it before. It was like writing another debut novel. I think every book requires its own way of being written. There's no way you can prepare for it. I tried to write a book in the same way that I had tried to write Burial Rites. I came to about 60,000 words, and then I had to realise that it just didn't have a pulse, and I had to toss it and start again. So hence why I felt a bit tired by the end of this one. But, you know, that's the challenge of writing, and in that challenge is also its beauty. So,
well, and you talked about Burial Rites. It's like, well, I didn't really know how hard it was, so I just weighed in, and then I just worked really hard until it was finished.
Yeah.
What about this one? I mean, knowing what you knew after Burial Rites, was it like, I will get to the end eventually?
Yes, I think I didn't feel that way. I felt that I would be writing this book until I was 60. I say that seriously. I thought I would never be finished because it felt very difficult and it was very challenging. But I also knew that I had chosen to write this book because I did want to extend myself. I didn't want to write another Burial Rites. I wanted to improve as a writer. And that, you know, you just have to trust in the knowledge that just keep going and hard work pays out more than anything else. So tried to keep that in mind.
Well, and it's going to be translated into several languages already. No pressure for the third book then, I'm sure.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks, Lori.
Got publicists kind of going, so, how tired? Do you have more notebooks with little ideas in them?
Oh, yeah, I've got a ton of notebooks and about five books bubbling away in the back of my mind. So we'll see which one I can sort of seize on next.
And you're going to be working on a film.
Yeah, this is really exciting for me. Again, kind of in the spirit of challenging myself and trying to continue to develop and be better. I'm working with Carver Films, which is a local production company. We recently received some funding to try and pull together the early stages of a feature film script. So that's really exciting.
That is going to be really, really interesting. I mean, is that something you've done before?
No, never. And I had to show them sort of a treatment the other day, and it was sort of first draft stuff. And I was like, I had a little panic attack about it. I'm not used to showing anyone anything that soon, but I had to remind myself, and it's like, no, it's a collaborative process. I must relinquish this control.
Yeah, if so. I do 50%, someone else will come in and do the other 50%.
Yeah, exactly. But that's, you know, that's part of the fun of it too, trying something new.
Well, and Geraldine Brooks did some mentoring with you for Burial Rites. Maybe you could just get someone, you know, low-key like that to mentor you with the script. Sure. I mean, what was that like to have Geraldine Brooks going, I'll read your draft?
Oh, my gosh, it was terrifying and wonderful. I was incredibly nervous. But she was fantastic, and she read the book as a reader, which was something that I hadn't yet had at the stage of that manuscript's development. Everyone who had read it had sort of had either a vested interest in the book, or, you know, was my friend or mother. So I she was really the first person who let me step back and regard the book as a whole. I think you can get, when you work on something for such a long time, you get so bogged in it, you can't really see the whole picture. And she gave me, we had an email exchange, that's the shape the mentorship took, and she gave me some lovely, very simple but incredibly poignant advice. She told me to, well, I remember the main thing that really changed, I guess, the consequent drafts, she told me to let more light in. And her words are always sort of ringing in my head. The book's, again, very still, very bleak, but I hope there is more light in, and I'd like to thank Geraldine for reminding me to do that.
Well, the bleakness is very, very precisely illuminated. So.
Yeah, it's interesting bleakness, right?
Yeah. Well, in the newspaper article, she kind of waves away, oh, I just told her to keep doing what she was doing, basically, and just, you know, continue down that path. But obviously there was more going on there.
Yeah, we had about 3 or 4 emails going back and forth, and she was really just like any great reader, just full of questions, which made me be able to simulate that new reading experience.
Well, yeah. I mean, the page on your bio of prizes is getting ridiculously long. Do they all blur together after a while, or does each new one just come up and go,
oh, it's always exciting. Of course it is. I hope I would never become someone who's like, oh, another award, brilliant. You know, I just, that's a terrible way to live your life. I still get excited that, you know, you've all come here tonight. That's the real thrill, is thinking, oh my gosh, people other than my family are reading my book. That's really exciting, and I remain very grateful for that. But of course, prizes are wonderful. It's just it's an honour to have anyone enjoy your work.
Well, and I obviously, as you can tell, really, really enjoyed this book, and it will be for sale up the back, Hill of Content. I've got a stack there, and Hannah will be signing them, and I heartily approve of that marriage. We have some time for questions, so there'll be some people standing with microphones at the side. If you want to ask a question of Hannah, just stick your hand up and they will come to you.
Hello. Thanks very much for tonight. It's great to hear you. I'm just wondering, and I don't know whether you want to dip your toe into this debate, but with the nature of the books you've written, the idea of appropriating stories from elsewhere and other cultures and what's being said about that at the moment, do you have any view about how your work plays into that debate?
Yeah, it's a very good question, the Shriver question, as it shall henceforth be known. And I'm glad that people are discussing this, because I think it warrants discussion and broad discussion and a lot of different voices and opinions weighing in on it. My views do change, and I think that's worth saying, and I'm glad they do. I think that's the nature of any kind of inquiry and consideration. You need to be open to changing your mind, especially about what you do. I sort of don't really sit on either end of the extreme. I don't feel that writers have a license to go and do whatever they want and will never be accountable for any offence caused, and offence can be caused. I'm very much of the position that if you believe in the power of literature, you must also agree that with power comes responsibility. And some of those responsibilities are ensuring that you're the best person to tell a story and to represent any of those that you are seeking to represent in your story, be it real persons or a particular culture, something different from your own immediate experience. I also don't think that you must only ever write from what you have experienced yourself, your own gender, your own sexuality, your own culture. I think fiction allows us to explore other experiences, and indeed it must. It must be open, it must embrace everything. However, with that responsibility that I mentioned earlier, I believe writers must consider their intentions, and I think they must consider the ethics of what it is that they are doing. I know I have, for both Burial Rites and The Good People, and I like to consider, I guess, my navigation of that very fine line between appropriation and exploitation and possibly emendation or accurate representation by having a very rigorous research methodology, making sure I actually do my work and just don't make things up. By, for instance, all of the historical remedies in the book are real, and I felt that was a nod of respect to the people to whom these folklore traditions are still very important. And I also try to always write from a position of empathy. And I think empathy is really crucial to this debate, and I'm surprised that people haven't spoken about it more, because I think if you write from a position of empathy, you're going to be respectful. You're going to be able to more clearly understand when you are not the right person to tell a story, when if you were to tell a story, you would be robbing someone or silencing someone of their particular experience. Like I say, my views might change again, but this is currently where I stand. And I feel fairly confident that I do try to write from a position of empathy. And I've never heard of anyone being offended by my work previously, and I would continue to hope that's the case. But if someone did come to me and say that they felt that I had exploited Irish culture, I'm sure it would make me think long and hard about what it was I was doing, and it probably would influence my decision to write a future work. So I hope that answers your question.
Quick supplementary question. A lot of the time in that discussion, people of colour talk about not just the individual things that white writers do, but about ways to make space for people who have been historically marginalised. As you said, you know, it's not just about what you do, but the context of the literary landscape. Have you seen any useful practical strategies for kind of enlarging that space for people of colour to tell their own stories?
Well, I have a magazine, Kill Your Darlings, and we have a very sort of conscious way of both soliciting content and also having an open as a submission of policy as possible, and trying to really, in our editorial meetings, concentrate on trying to get various and varied representation, trying to get multiple voices across the whole spectrum, you know, and that includes emerging and established writers as well. I think anyone who wants to have a vibrant literary world, you know, must think that for any ecology to function, we need variety and we need discussion and we sometimes need contradiction and complexity. And you know, we don't want to dilute our publishing industry by only ever publishing one particular kind of writer. I think people are increasingly aware of it, but it's, like I say, it's why it's worth talking about. It's a good reminder to all of us.
Hi, Hannah. I loved your previous book, so I've got your new book under my chair already.
Oh, thank you.
That's great. I'm just intrigued about the ancestry of the characters in your book. You say that they're real people, obviously, but I don't want you to give it away what happens. So, but just whether you researched if, you know, they had families and all of that.
Yeah, I'd really tried to. I went to a lot of census records and parish records, and I couldn't find them at all. And that it's not to say that they're not there, but there's a lot of the record keeping in Ireland is confused, I guess, by the Protestant or English authorities in Ireland at that time. So you have people like my characters who would have been living in an Irish speaking world with place names, with Irish names, and then everything is written down in English largely. So names are changed, sort of are anglicised as our place names, and that also varies depending on the record. So there's sometimes a lack of consistency, which makes it, in my experience, really difficult to try and track people. I did try to find these women and I couldn't find them at all. I'm hoping maybe one day someone will come to me with some extra information that I could belatedly publish on my website, but no, so far. So it is very much more a work of fiction than burial rites.
Hi, I was just wondering if there are any dark, cold areas of Australian historic times you'd be interested in writing about in the future.
That's a good question. Well, I've actually I've always been fascinated by the Barossa and the sort of the people who settled much of the Barossa. It's tied in with my own family. I'm not sure if it's necessarily cold and grey, but it is a place that I'm really fascinated with, and I do have a few ideas for that place. But I might step away from the rain and the snow, to be honest. It's my heating broke halfway through writing this book, and it was sort of insufferable to kind of inhabit both a freezing cold office and also a freezing cold world. So we'll see. I'm afraid I can't quite answer that yet.
I think I picked that bit where the heating went out. I suddenly feel a chill in this book.
There's a drop in temperature on the page.
Ice.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was amazing, that squelch of bare feet through mud and the bucket at the door for washing the feet after you come back was an unbelievable kind of vivid detail of life at that time.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, you spoke earlier about some of the weird things that happen when you write a book, and certainly that happened with Burial Rites. Something I was asked recently if I have any weird kind of woo-woo mystic writer stuff that I rely on, and I do love it when it happens, but unfortunately I can't control it, and I tend to have very vivid sensory dreams of these worlds that I'm writing about. And I remember I was really struggling to write a Nance's cabin. I couldn't picture it. There was nothing like it in the open air museums I had visited. And then one night I had this dream where I walked into her cabin and I looked around, and I remember being in my dream, oh, of course the fire would be set away from the wall, and there's, what's that bucket for? Oh, surely it's for washing your feet. And I could see the murk in the water, and I could see the bucket, and I could see the soot on the wall from the absence of a chimney and how low, and there wasn't a window. And I suddenly realised, oh, of course you'd need to leave the half door open. You'd always be leaving the door open, even if it was cold, to let the light in. And then I woke up and thought, oh, better write that down.
And then switch the heater on.
Yeah, and then try to switch the heater on.
I think we've got another question up here.
Hi, I've actually got a question about burial rites. I just wondered, which was a fantastic book, but I'm quite intrigued why the case had such an impact on the, you know, national Icelandic psyche. Have you got any comment on that?
I think it really comes down to the fact that crime was relatively rare, certainly of this scale in Iceland. I mean, there's only 320,000 of them these days, and back then communities were incredibly small. The time when the murders at Illugastad occurred was sort of a criminal period for this valley, as I read, but that criminality was really reduced to stealing sheep. And so for two people to be killed, you know, it was an extraordinary event. It wasn't particularly common at all. They actually didn't, I think, get rid of capital punishment until over 100 years later, but no one died because simply a crime of that, I guess, that stature hadn't been committed. So I think that's really the reason why. And also, you know, it was a very dramatic crime with the house being burnt down and women involved as well. So I think there was something about it. And also it being the last significant crime and the last executions in Iceland. I think that's why people still now remember it. But, yeah, certainly because they was just simply rare.
Please give Hannah a very, very warm thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.